creaking British Museum of Pop Culture. It's dark, it's mostly underground, it's full of ghosts, but you'd be surprised what you find down here. I'm Andrew Harrison, and joining me, as ever, is Sean Pattenden, the sophisticated Nancy Sinatra to my flea-bitten Lee Hazelwood. Hello, Sean. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you, Andrew Harrison.
Exciting week?
Very exciting, thank you.
What's been happening?
The more Brexit biscuit prints that I've been producing, and I'm going to produce a whole stream more of my protest anti-Brexit faux carte biscuits for July.
Faux carte biscuits?
Oh, yes.
Well, there's going to be a biscuit-heavy show as we'll discover later.
I think it is, isn't it? Yeah.
Joining us, we have two exciting guests. He's a contributing editor at Monocle and the host of The Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio, the award-winning Foreign Desk. Winner of the News and Current Affairs Podcast of the Year at the British Podcast Awards a couple of weeks ago, just pipping our sister show, Romaniacs. Actually, not pipping us. You beat us by a mile, didn't you? He's also a Melody Maker veteran and the author of It's Too Late to Die Young Now, Misadventures in Rock and Roll, and a country rock artiste with the Blazing Zoos. It's Andrew Mueller. Hello, Andrew. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right. Not bad. Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the award. You've had some fun on the Foreign Desk the past couple of weeks with the Ukrainian politician faking his own assassination.
We haven't actually looked into that one on the Foreign Desk as such. We did talk about it a lot on one of Monocle's other shows, The Daily. It's a glorious story. We did consider doing a sort of special concept episode, but we just thought there wasn't a half-hour-long answer to what the hell.
Yeah.
It's strange, isn't it? It seems like a really weird thing to do, he said, to state. That's the kind of insight that won me the award.
Yeah.
To observe that faking one's own death to escape an assassination plot without telling your wife in advance just seems like kind of an odd way to behave.
It's the kind of thing that you do to get out of going to Centre Parks, maybe, or doing the thing. But, yeah, to faking your own death, doing a Reginald Perrin, is one thing. Faking your own assassination is
well. I did think at the time, you know, let any journalist with a deadline who's never at least thought about this cast the first stone. Yeah.
Well, I look at Canoe Man and I think, could you do that? Could you know? I got the Lee Valley Canal and just sort of disappear. It's possible, isn't it?
Yes, I'm unable to submit my copy as I am being pursued by a death squad from the FSB, and as a result of which I have faked my own death in a stairwell.
Yes, that's the one to do.
Can I file on Thursday?
Absolutely. Yeah, when I'll be alive again. Do you find that your background in interviewing myriad rock stars gives you a different perspective on world events? I mean, you know, when you've got sort of a key analyst on the Chechen conflict, you say, you know, what's your favourite Replacements album? Things like that.
Off the record, that does actually happen quite a lot.
Okay.
Everybody, it turns out, does have a favourite Replacements album. And I think if you start as a rock journalist, which I think, unfortunately, is an increasingly difficult thing for people to do, it's not, even if you stop writing about music, you never really stop being a rock journalist. You always think like a rock journalist. When you're looking at any story, you're looking for the angle that no one else has quite thought of. You can take the sort of irreverent, right-angled, askew, I'm trying to avoid saying wry, sidelong look here, but I think it inculcates you with a certain sensibility, which you can, and indeed should, I think, apply to other things.
So you're saying that, you know, you still want to ask whoever works with gorillas, what colour is Tuesday?
That's an excellent question.
Yeah.
Well, we had the Turkish novelist and human rights campaigner Elif Shafak on Nick Clegg's podcast this week, which he also produced Anger Management with Nick Clegg. And it emerged that she's a massive fan of black metal. So this woman who sort of advocates for women's rights in the Islamic world and LGBT, oh yes, I can't write without, you know, Norwegian church burning music on in the background. There you go.
Amazing stuff. Also joining us this week, he interviews pop stars for Q and famous people for The Big Issue. He's the most disturbing thing to come out of Ballymena since the Boris Bus, or maybe Reverend Ian Paisley, and he's got his own book coming out soon. It's the very Reverend Eamon Ford. Hello, Eamon, how are you?
I like that, Reverend Eamon Ford. Yeah.
Can I count on your vote?
I did meet Ian Paisley once. I think I was about 14, 15 in Ballymena. I was in my school uniform. St. Louis Grammar School. Shout out to the St. Louis Grammar School Kintala Massive. And obviously that was a big giveaway as to your demographic your demographic bracketing. And I was walking past the DUP offices in the middle of Ballymena, not a very big town, and Ian Paisley walked out and I bumped into him. And I kind of, it was like the cartoon moment where you look up and it just, he keeps going. He was enormous.
They didn't call him the big man for nothing.
He was
a
like,
big bloke.
He was enormous. I was obviously standing there shaking, and there was some local council election was coming up, and he just boomed down on me. He said, "I trust I can count on your vote." And I kind of trampled it down and ran away. And obviously, he clearly did have a sense of humour, because he will victimise Catholic school children in the street.
So, Eamon, you've just finished your book. What's your book about?
I've nearly finished book. Oh, I'm doing the final edits in the next couple of weeks. My book is on the final years of EMI, when it got bought by Terra Firma, the private equity company, and for £4.2 billion. And within 3 years, they completely lost control of it, and EMI got scattered to the four winds and hoovered up by all the other music companies. Mm. And now it does not exist except as a suffix. It's now part of Universal Music Group, and it is referred to as Virgin EMI. Ironically, it bought Virgin in the early 90s, and now
it's
just kind of tagged on to the end. And like obviously, Parlophone exists as part of Warner, but that's it. It's gone. Right, so it's explaining why that happened. So I've gone full investigative journalist.
Yeah. Do you know what it's going to be called yet?
I do, but I can't give it away.
Top secret.
A great title. It's from a line in the court case when Terra Firma was suing Citigroup over potentially misleading them about a rival bid for EMI, which possibly inflated the price that they paid for it. So it's from an internal email that was given as evidence during the court case, and as soon as I saw it, I went, book title.
So Eamon Ford's book,
When's
Do
it
Not
out?
Forward, is coming out soon.
It's scheduled for March.
I'm sure we'll be talking about it when it comes out.
If I haven't been sued inside.
So Andrew, what have we got on the show, mate?
On Big Mouth this week, remember Get Shorty with John Travolta as Chili Palmer, the mobster who ends up in the movie business in Hollywood. It's now a Sky Atlantic TV series with Chris O'Dowd as a slightly more down-at-heel mobster, doing the same thing, getting into the movies. Does it work? And should we keep retooling bite-sized movies into open-ended TV epics? Plus, exactly how Smithsy is Johnny Marr's new album, Call the Comet? And now that Morrissey has gone all Tommy Robinson on us, should we stop worrying and accept that Johnny was always the best one in the Smiths? Also, fantastic Negriso. Exotic cocktail, super woke superhero, or Grammy-winning rock and roll blues person from Oakland? Clue, it's the latter. Is his new album, Please Don't Be Dead, any good, and who will like it? Plus, Andrew, Eamon and I go to see Reborn and reform Joycean Rock Ranters Micro Disney. How are their Dublin and London shows, and will I be able to pronounce Carl Coughlin's name properly? Was that right?
Cackle.
That's pretty good, actually.
Cackle, it's a
cackle. Okay, Cackle Coughlin.
That wasn't a bad first swing, actually.
Okay.
I've heard worse.
I am Irish linguistic pronunciation expert, so
fantastic.
Yes, any other questions like that about Quiver or Saoirse, I can sort that for you.
Fair dues. In another part of an irregular series later in the show, our guests will fess up to the album that only they like. All these things and more after this important message.
If this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give up and cry, 1 hour of Big Mouth is the light glimmering in the gloom, so say live and let pledge. If you like Big Mouth, and you must, we're asking you to stump up only £5 a month. That's the equivalent of a pint of beer, even in a Wetherspoons, via the Crowdfunding People Patreon. It'll help us cover our bills, and we're already halfway to our target of £600 a month. Once we hit it, we'll start recording extra bits each week for our Patreon backers. Go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. The link is at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page too. All we are saying is, live and let pledge.
There we go. Right, let's start with Johnny Marr. If Morrissey stuck slavishly to the sound of the Smiths after they split, Johnny Marr fled away obsessively from it, making baggy megapop with electronic lumpy blues with his strange band The Healers, and joining bands from The to The Cribs and Modest Mouse when you really wish he'd just start standing like himself again. A long 25-year arc brought him back to that sound with the album The Messenger in 2013. Call the Comet is his third nominal solo album, and we're going to see what it's like after this track, Hi Hello. And if a double-decker bus crashes into us, that was Hi Hello from Call the Comet by Johnny Marr. And it's very Smithsy, isn't it? But Eamon Ford, it is his sound. Surely he's, of all people, is allowed to revisit it.
Absolutely. I was kind of struck by this album because the first half of it, I was just going, oh, God, it's like he was kind of in riff mode. And you think of like such an accomplished, intricate guitarist just kind of churning out these riffs just seemed really workmanlike. Mm. But about maybe a third or a halfway through, it completely flipped. And I think it just stylistically, it just became a lot more interesting. Mm. So first half, it's kind of a bit meat and potatoes. Mm. Ironic for a vegetarian.
Potatoes and potatoes.
Potatoes and more potatoes. But I thought I really liked the second half. I think it was him maybe kind of coming back full circle to the Smiths because there were like very clear echoes in a lot of the stylistic structure of the songs and the kind of the intricate guitar playing that he first became famous for and obviously had spent years in denial kind of hanging around with the Cribs or Modest Mouse and just kind of making this kind of noisy punk rock or art rock. And I think he's just come back to the fact that he likes to play.
Well, with with Morrissey, he had like 30 years of thinking, well, this is what the Smiths would sound like without Johnny Marr. It's got its ups and downs. We can finally find out what the Smiths would have sounded like without Morrissey.
Yeah.
And it's this.
Yeah. I think kind of the lyrics probably, I think we can skip over the lyrics. Well, they don't really say much, do they?
It's apparently kind of based in the idea of, extraterrestrials, intelligences coming to Earth to sort out the mess that we've made ourselves. Mm. And this is the comet, you know, things are appearing. But it's quite opaque and quite sort of, and also I think not really very important because you're not here for insight and words. You're here to bathe in the world of Johnny Marnus, aren't you? Yeah. Andrew Mueller, what did you reckon?
Much the same, actually. I came to the Smiths kind of late. They were sort of a tough sell to an adolescent Australian. They're the least Australian-sounding band I could possibly imagine, the Smiths. But my way into the Smiths was I was a Marr person rather than a Morrissey person because I thought, you know, he's clearly an extraordinary, astonishing guitar player. And he is. He's a ridiculous guitar player. Mm. He's in that league above people who were really, really good. Hmm. This album, it has all that great stuff on it, all the Johnny Marr thing that you liked, and that song that you played a selection of, it is basically There Is a Light That Never Goes Out. It is a Smith song without Morrissey. But the thing is, and I know that things being as they are, this is an unfashionable opinion, it kind of makes you remember what was great about Morrissey as well, that the Smiths were a two-horse contraption, as it were. Because the thing is with Johnny Marr, beautiful though the guitar playing is, beautiful though the arrangements are, there's both the lyrics and the voice which conveys it are really not terrifically interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he'd ever claim himself to be a capital S singer.
But the thing is, if you're Johnny Marr, you can get any capital S singer to come and sing on your damn record. Why would you not?
There's a kind of there's a issue that I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about that very point about like his lyric delivery. It's very competent. He can sing, he's in key, it's kind of he hits all the notes or whatever. But you're kind of wondering, is he kind of reining in the writing of the music to suit his voice? Because if he had a more prolific singer, would that therefore result in even more prolific and intricate songwriting? Or is he kind of reining in the composition of the song so that he can actually sing it? He's writing these songs for his voice.
But then surely he did that with Morrissey, because Morrissey's range isn't that broad anyway.
And Morrissey had all of that kind of whipping and hollering at the early Smiths.
They're one-note melodies a lot of the time, and Johnny's guitar is going under that. And so I think he is used to that and realises there are limitations. I really liked it. And the vocals are mixed really low. He knows that, you know, it's not lyrically, it's not going to be Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now. But there's something about that, and something that creating of the atmosphere that I thought was really brave.
Well, he clearly really knows how to write for his own voice.
Mm. Mm. We're discussing this entirely in the context of the Smiths. I mean, it's kind of unfair to him, isn't it? You know, he has done things subsequently in 30, you know, Johnny Marr's career and his output is so varied that it's possible to be a follower and a fan and not like all of it. Like, I cannot abide the Healers. No. The Healers were quite terrible. But I still
he does
regard myself as a real Marr enthusiast.
It's that mixed blessing, though, is once you've done something that defines a moment, which is an occupational hazard if you're kind of a genius pop singer or pop writer, you are therefore condemned to live it forever and ever and ever. And I know people forget that Johnny Marr, when he left the Smiths, was what, 25? Maybe
23.
Not, maybe
like
not
a couple of weeks away from his 24th birthday, yeah, I think.
He was
which is
astonishing. So he left the Smiths when he was basically a child. And the thing is, whatever he's done done or will do since then, however great it is, on its own merits, the first line of his obituary is going to be Johnny Marr, guitarist in the Smiths, which that is a better lifetime's work than most people are going to do, certainly. But it must be very weird and I guess slightly melancholy being in that position. Every show he plays, he knows that there's a big part of the crowd just waiting for the encores when he does one of the ones that they've come to hear him do.
But isn't that's the story of the solo career, isn't it? He's kind of making his peace with that sound. This is my sound. I created it. Why should I not do it? Why should I not enjoy it and do it as well as I possibly can?
That point about kind of always being Johnny Marr from the Smiths, he was the first ever pop star I interviewed for that electronic album with Rasputin on the cover. Yeah. When was that? Like kind of 99, 2000?
Twisted Tenderness, about 99, something like that.
And obviously, like, he raised the Smiths, so I thought, fair game, I'll ask him about the Smiths. And then I said, like, it's clearly frustrating that you will always be Johnny Marr from the Smiths. And he said, well, it's no, I'm very happy with that, because I'd much rather be Johnny Marr from the Smiths from that, or that bloke from Kajagoogoo. like, he's obviously had rehearsed that line, but it was a good line. Yeah. And like, he was clearly very proud of what the Smiths were, and he knew that he was never going to escape the shadow of that. Yeah. And I think maybe this album is him kind of really coming to peace with all of
but
that.
But to be fair, I mean, it's not just exclusively songs that sound like the Smiths. There's a fair bit of krautrock in there. There's bits that sound like Blue Oyster Cult.
The very last
song, which is A Different Gun, reminded me of something off the last Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds album. It kind of had that kind of, like, the production that David Holmes brought to those first couple of singles off that, it reminded me a little bit of that. So
I do want to point out as well that on Day In, Day Out, there is actually quite a rarity for Johnny Marr, given that he can play guitar like he can. It has an actual proper foot on the monitor guitar solo, which it's not something he does very often. He's very modest.
There you go. Okay, well, I think broadly speaking, most of us like... I mean, I really liked it.
Second half I thought was brilliant.
Yeah.
First half,
okay, well, let's move on with a bit of different music. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune. Eamon Ford, what have you brought in for the listeners and why?
I have brought in a track by a new London band, I think. The problem is not many people know very much about them. They're called Black Midi, and this is ostensibly their first single. It's called BM, 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 I think. I don't
BM,
know.
BM, BM. There's only three BMs.
Right, okay.
Or is it pronounced bum, bum, bum?
It might be. There's no indication of what the lyrics are. They've been kind of kicking around for a year, I believe, and they haven't really played that much. This is their first single. It's only available as like 250 7 inches, and it's on SoundCloud. They've done it for this label called Speedy Wondergrind, and their whole thing is you get one song, you get 24 hours to go in, record it, mix it, finish it, that's it, everything has to be done in one day. So they put this track out. I saw them last night in the Windmill in Brixton, and it was like absolutely just heaving with kind of A&Rs. Clearly they are like the hot band of the moment, and they're just this weird mix between kind of like, I hate the term math rock, but something like Battles, this kind of really kind of like minimal repetition thing, and Talking Heads, and he's got this weird kind of falsetto singing voice, and it's like, it's about stripping everything back. It's really raw. They all look about 17. The drummer is astonishing. I would pay upwards of £1,000 to watch him play on his own for an hour. He's just phenomenal, and they make a hell of a racket, and lots of people will hate it, but they are quite exciting.
Well, let's find out if you hate it. This is Boom 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 by Black Midi.
Man, what a purpose! It's such a purpose, it is so magnificent, it is such a magnificent purpose, it is such a purpose, and it is so magnificent. So magnificent. So magnificent. It is such a magnificent purpose.
That was Bum 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 by Black Midi. Hope I'm saying that right. As chosen by Eamon Ford. Now, it used to be that if TV shows were really well received and popular, they might get made into a movie. Think Porridge, Steptoe and Son, and Holiday on the Buses. Now it's the other way around, which brings us to that remake of Get Shorty on Sky Atlantic. Out goes John Travolta, and in comes Chris O'Dowd as Irish crimo Miles Daly, and a somewhat post-Breaking Bad sensibility. After HBO's superlative Barry, do we need another tale of criminals trying to make it in the movie business? Let's have a bit of Atmos.
Matt, I want you to make a collection in LA. If the guy doesn't pay, close the account.
I'm such an idiot. Trying to finance a movie playing blackjack.
What's that? A movie.
Do me a favor and scoot over that way.
Why?
Well, cleaning your brains off that bookcase is going to be a hassle. You got paper towels? That's the real question.
If I change my job, she might take me back.
How hard can it be?
You asked me to make a movie with cash.
A taste of Get Shorty with Chris O'Dowd there. Andrew Mueller. This is Hollywood's two favourite subjects, downhill crime and Hollywood. And Hollywood's favourite location, Hollywood. Does Get Shorty hit the spot for you? Did you enjoy it?
I thought it was all... My assessment of it is the most boring possible assessment anybody can give of anything, which is I thought it was all right.
Yeah.
It's affable. It's agreeable. He is very good. He plays very well that sort of... I mean, it's not a big reach for him at this point. It's Chris O'Dowd playing a sort of shambling, dishevelled wretch, not quite sure what he's really doing. Which is what he does, but he does it very well.
Yeah.
You can't go too far wrong, I think, with adapting anything either literally or in the spirit of Elmore Leonard, which is what this is. It's a reminder of... most rules about writing are terrible and stupid, but one of his is actually very, very good, which is that nobody ever skips pages of dialogue. And I thought a lot of the dialogue lived up to that edict. It's a very... talky thing.
Well, the kind of conceit is Chris O'Dowd as Miles. He's a kind of corpse disposer, cleaner upper type of chap.
Who is
working for the mob? Yes, it's a dirty job, but literally somebody's got to do it. They have to go and do a job in Hollywood. They have to go and collect a debt, and if the debt isn't paid, then the account will be closed, as it were. I.e., the person will get shot. And through a hilarious sequence of events, he basically ends up in possession of quite a good movie script. He's looking for a way out of his dead end life of putting bodies in quicklime and digging holes, and he thinks he can get into the movie business, and things go from there. You know, he takes the idea to the mob boss as a way of laundering money.
But it's also him trying to go legit in a way, because he's separated from his wife, and he wants to kind of prove to her and their daughter that he can actually do something good. So this is also his... attempt to kind of clean up his life or to go straight in a way.
What did you make of it?
We thought the first episode was kind of very slow moving, kind of setting it all up. But by episode three, however, it took a really interesting twist. And I obviously can't say what that is for spoiler alert. But suddenly this kind of shambolic guy suddenly reveals a really, really dark kind of dead-eyed kind of ambitious side to himself that he will just do whatever has to be done in a very calm way to kind of get things done. But halfway through, I was kind of intrigued by his accent, and referring back to me being the expert of all Irish languages with my wonderful mellifluous recreation of Ireland via Bristol in the Midlands for some reason. I don't know why. But his accent really fucks me, because I was trying to place it, because he's originally from County Roscommon. If people have ever seen, which you should watch if you haven't seen it already, Moon Boy, his kind of recreation of growing up in rural Ireland in the late 80s, early 90s, which is absolutely wonderful, and I hope there's another series of that soon. But it's not a Roscommon accent, and I'm kind of going, it was a little bit Cork, maybe a little bit Cork. It was like all over the place.
This might be a bit inside baseball.
This is a bit inside baseball, but that kind of kept throwing me a little bit, because I think he's a really good actor. He can do straight, he can do comic, he can do darkly comic as well. And like he's obviously doing a lot of the heavy lifting in this show, but the accent, it wasn't quite Sean Connery in The Untouchables, but it kind of wobbled a little bit for me. Yeah. So that kind of threw me a little bit.
The theme of the show is essentially, or the theme of the story in both senses, is that like when you think the world of organised crime is full of sharks, well, wait till you meet the movie business. And the original movie is very concise and in a lot of ways actually quite cheerful, because there's a great scene in it where Travolta has to beat up. He's attacked by a mob enforcer played by James Gandolfini from The Sopranos. And Travolta beats him easily in a fight, and then sort of comforts him and says, no, it's okay, don't worry, calm down, it's all right, nothing bad's going to happen. It really plays against the type of a mob movie, and I found that really endearing in the original. I think it's Barry Sonnenfeld directed the original movie. My problem with this is that it sort of has this kind of decaffeinated version of Tarantino where, you know, people are discussing, you know, their hopes and dreams while they're sawing the arm off a corpse, or discussing going to the dentist while they go on their way to a hit. That no longer feels new. And it didn't really have enough, none of it played enough against type to excite me. It's like the mob boss is a merciless, cold-eyed killer. She has no humour. She has no side to her.
There's a backstory. There's a flashback explaining why she's become this character, which obviously I don't want to give that away. Sure. But there's a very clear reason why she is this ruthless person.
But the comparison for me is Barry, which we mentioned earlier, which is running on Sky right now, which is to me immeasurably superior because Barry, the hitman played by Bill Hader. He's in a similar position. He's a hitman. He doesn't want to be a hitman anymore. He wants to act. And the mob that he's fallen in with are these hilarious Chechens who are, you know, kind of reading self-improvement manuals and sort of punching each other on the shoulder to be on the up and up. And, hey, come on, guys, we can get this done. It's so not what you expect from the world of crime. And I found it really refreshing. Whereas my problem with this is it just felt like if you'd made this in 1999, it would have felt immensely new. Now it just feels like I'm slightly behind the beat.
Well, on the subject of things that I didn't enjoy it quite as much as, I was sort of put irritably in mind a lot of the time or reminded of a previous Elmore Leonard adaptation, which was one of my favourite TV programmes of the last decade or so, which was Justified, starring Timothy Oliphant as the... I mean, yeah, he was a maverick cop who didn't play by the rules but got things done and had a torturous personal life, etc. But one of the reasons Justified worked was it acknowledged the cliches within which it was working. There was always a little bit of an arched eyebrow to camera, though not too much that it actually spoilt the story. But that whole series was beautifully written and beautifully acted.
I thought, unlike Tarantino, where you have this idea, as you're saying, that, you know, they're talking about the dentist while they're going up to a hit, those characters are two-dimensional. Mm. And you're getting Chris O'Dowd over, saying, 10 hours to reveal the person that he is. And he has this wonderful speech in it, because it's also, this is a programme about storytelling. Why are we so addicted to binge-watching these things? Why do we lose ourselves in stories all the time? Because the world is such a terrible place. I think it's also talking about that. Yeah. And he's saying, being a tough guy is not sexy, he's saying to his partner in crime, as literally it is. He says, you know, you go home, you're lifting blood from under your nails, then you're watching Storage Wars. What is it all about?
Yeah.
In that crime is mundane and it's boring and he wants to lift himself. And because Chris O'Dowd is so good, and we watch Martin Freeman in that other Netflix thing, Chris O'Dowd has been the nice guy. He's been in the IT crowd. Yeah. He's done that. But there's a scene where someone is pointing a gun at his head, apropos of nothing, and he doesn't flinch. Yeah. And actually just to watch him and to watch his character unfold, I think, is the strength of it. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
I only got three episodes in. I would have bailed after two, but then there's a really subtle gear change in his character and the story in episode three, and I went, right, I'm in for this now. It's taken three episodes to do that. They could have done that much quicker. Yeah. They could have done that by the end of episode one, because they've got 60 minutes per episode.
This is the problem of the Netflix binge watching hero. You know, this is another show which needs to decide where it's going to go and get there a little bit quicker. But from what you've said, I think I'm going to give it a further chance.
I think we are at the CD equivalent of Netflix, which was the CD was invented. It was a sound carrier that held 78 minutes. Everything before that was 45 minutes. But by the 90s, people felt that they had to fill the 78 minutes. And now I think that people will go, well, a Netflix series or a Sky Atlantic series, it has to be at least 10 episodes. They all have to be an hour long. So people are expecting that. Mm. And I think brevity will be the next wave of this, I hope. The more succinct, let's get everything down. Five episodes, 30 minutes each, bang.
This is what I love about Barry. 30-minute episodes. Yeah, they're great. Get in, do it, get gone.
As the young people of the internet say, I am here for this.
Absolutely. Don't bore us, get to the chorus, as Rock said so very wisely. Okay, well, you've persuaded me. I'm going to keep sticking.
Yeah,
I'm going to keep going with this.
Yeah, episode three, I think, is the real start, I hope.
Okay. It's time to ask Andrew Muller which track he's bought in. And this one has a bit of a story behind it, does it not?
It does. This is Singer's Hampstead Home by Micro Disney. It's actually, weirdly, which is not something anyone's been able to say about Micro Disney for nearly 30 years, kind of actually topical, because they have been playing for the first time in about 30 years. They played at the Barbican on Saturday night and at the National Concert Theatre, one of those two things, in Dublin the Saturday before that. I was at both shows.
Mm. We're going to talk about that after we listen to the tune. So let's listen to the tune, then let's chat about Micro Disney, please.
Pop songs and happy ends. You know they did, but you still pretend. On the telephone, say goodbye, say you won't be home.
Singer's House at Home by Mike Disney, as chosen by Andrew Mueller, famously about Boy George, wasn't it?
It was. I think it was originally written as a response to the tabloid circus surrounding Boy George at the time, yes.
Yeah. I thought there was a Geldof reference to it as well.
Really?
Mm. I don't know, maybe I just read that into it, as in Ari Singer has a pop at another Ari Singer.
Well, we all went to see the reunion shows last week, and Eamon fantastically got amazing tickets right on the second row. I've never been, in 30 years of blagging tickets, I've never had such good tickets, and these were paid for, so that's amazing. Eamon, quickly explain Micro Disney to the uninitiated.
Oh my
Irish
goodness.
Desk.
Well, they are the great lost Irish band, even though 50% of the key songwriting partnership was English, a transplant, Sean O'Hagan, who moved to Cork, I think, as a kid in the 70s. So apparently they met, him and Cathal Coughlan met at a New Year's Eve party in 1979, symbolism alert, and they decided to kind of form a band. So I guess kind of, as you saw with Sean O'Hagan, years later went on to do the Highlanders. His kind of thing was kind of big West Coast harmonies, a bit of country music was in there. Whereas Cathal Coughlan was just this kind of screeching consciousness of the New Ireland that was about to come, this the kind of the railing against the hypocrisy and corruption and kind of broken lives and so forth, which was obviously at that point in kind of 70s, 80s, Ireland was kind of very much brushed under the carpet. There was still a legacy of De Valera's kind of frugal self-sufficiency grip in Ireland. The church was incredibly powerful. Obviously, that's all kind of unraveled. So there was this weird contrast between these beautiful, beautiful arrangements that Sean O'Hagan had written and just this vicious venom coming out of Cathal Coughlan, and I think it was that complete light and shade that really made them. And then they signed to Rough Trade and then never really had any hits, did two albums with Virgin, I think, and then split up because they just kind of felt that the wheels had fallen off at all. But they should have been massive.
Andrew, you've actually made records with Cathal Coughlan, haven't you?
I have collaborated on one slightly peculiar concept album with Cathal. I've known him for a long time. I first met him when I wrote about the band he formed after Micro Disney, which was the Fatima Mansions, who actually turned out to be another great lost Irish band.
Yes.
You can't find most of their records for Love Nor Gold anymore either. I thought both shows were fantastic. Well, I'm slightly biased, obviously, but honestly, my favourite part of both shows was actually the response to them.
Yes.
I mean, as I said, I've known Cathal a long time. He is one of my favourite dozen songwriters of all time ever. I think he is an actual proper certifiable genius, which is not a word I throw around lightly. And I just thought two largish rooms full of people standing up and applauding is something he should have got to see a couple of, actually a lot more often. But, you know, twice is not bad.
They seem to be having an absolute ball as well. The joy of being together playing that music was so...
The London show was noticeably less kind of nervous, I think.
Right, okay.
I think the Dublin show, because it's the first show and it's Ireland, but it worked and it was great and everybody enjoyed it. And I think the London show, they just thought, we can do this.
Was it effectively the same set list for both?
Literally, exactly, yeah. Okay. I think.
I never saw them first time around.
And I thought,
I loved The Clock Comes Down the Stairs, which is the album they played in its entirety, and a lot of the Virgin stuff, which is difficult to get a hold of now. This was genuinely one of the best things I've ever seen.
I thought it was extraordinarily
absolutely transfixing performance. Thought Cathal looked incredible. He looks like bloody Michael Fassbender these days. I don't understand it. There used to be a lot of him, didn't there? Used to be a fair bit of him.
It's
now
a teetotal vegan.
He is indeed a teetotal vegan.
Yeah. Oh, God.
He's a fit man.
Yes. But it was genuinely like an electrifying performance. Songs are amazing, beautifully played. I went back and listened to some of the records. They're better players now. They sound so much better. And the sound was so meatier and so much more exciting.
He's also got one of those... Well, I think he always had one of those voices, but so it has proved that it's got better with age.
Yeah.
It has rounded out. There's more depth and more warmth to it.
But also, if you're singing songs about, the outside world being dreadful, but also your own failings and, you know, booze and breakups and infidelities and doubt and all the rest of it, this stuff sounds better in your 50s than when you're 25.
No, absolutely.
You've lived a bit of it.
No, I thought I didn't have any doubt that the shows were going to be good. I know how much work went into rehearsing it, and they were either going to do it right or they weren't going to do it. But yeah, I thought they were magnificent.
I think they absolutely have to keep doing this, and I want to crowdfund a tour in which Micro Disney play supported by Fatima Mansions and the High Llamas. They can support themselves.
I would certainly throw in 20 quid towards that.
Okay.
A lot more.
But I suspect it's unlikely.
I would throw in my Hampstead home for that. I don't have one, but I will.
Right, let's move on to something slightly different. Oakland hip-hop blues rock headbanger Mr. Fantastic Negrito is one of those rare individuals whose stage name is more pronounceable than his real name, which is Javier De Frepeles, with a lot of PHs in there and two Zs. Hell of a Scrabble hand. His new album, Please Don't Be Dead, mashes up contemporary politics and Black Lives Matter themes with every element of Black American music you can think of. And he's got quite a story and quite a pen. We'll be hearing about it after this from the album. We'll be hearing about both those things after this track from the album. I said it was going to be a biscuit-heavy show. This is Transgender Biscuits. Ooh, looks like nobody's coming to my party. Fantastic Negrito with Transgender Biscuits from the album Please Don't Be Dead. I'm happy enough with that. I got fired because I'm a Muslim. I got fired because I'm a Jew. I got fired for being an asshole. I got fired for being late. This guy has an insane story. Raised as an Orthodox Muslim as the eighth of 14 kids. Moved from conservative Massachusetts neighbourhood to Oakland, which is a lot more lively. He made a flop solo album. He was put in a 3-week coma by a car accident, after which he could not play. He then became an urban farmer of vegetables and other vegetable-based consumables. Then he had to relearn how to play, and 8 years later, he reinvents himself as Fantastic Negrito. This is an astonishing record. Andrew Mueller, you get the blues. What did you make of this?
I thought the track we've played, Transgender Biscuits, was far and away my favourite thing on the record. I think it's a simple idea for a song. It's very funny. It's one of those lyrical devices that if you can pull it off, I think it's the lyrical equivalent to the comedy sketch setup of the guy standing on a rake and getting smacked in the face. It's funny the first time, and then funny the second and third times, then it tails off a bit, and then the 10th and 11th times
it gets funnier again,
becomes gradually more hysterical from that point. And I think that's a great example of that kind of writing. It reminded me of something by Tom Waits or Jim White or somebody of that ilk. A lot of the rest of the album I found getting a little bit Lenny Kravitz.
It is a little bit Lenny Kravitz and a little bit kind of Living Colour Black Rock Coalition. But I liked the humour, the closing track, Bullshit Anthem, has the refrain, take this bullshit and make it good shit. And I liked that as a sentiment. And this is generally not the
I don't know. That struck me as something that you would see on a poster in a whimsical cafe.
You might, but then if it's sung by
And indeed, you probably will now.
Possibly so. But if it's sung by a howling blues fellow with a load of noisy hip-hop blues and rock and roll behind it, maybe you are here for this. Eamon Ford, are you here for this?
The first play, I just went, oh, it's so obvious where all the references are from. You go, oh, this one's a bit Led Zeppelin, this one's a bit Prince, this one's a bit James Brown. This is a bit Outkast. This is about N.E.R.D. And I kind of went, oh, I don't really get this. And then I played it again, and you forget that. I think it's the kind of the force of his personality comes across, and he's a proper builder and a proper showman as well. And the lyrics were amazing. And it's like there's some very obvious bits. There's a song on there called November Street, which is basically House of the Rising Sun rewritten. And I think once you get over that, you just go, well, it's just a rush of an album. I really, really liked it. I think that, like, the reference points were so obvious, but I think he breathed new life into which is probably a cliche to say it, but I just felt he, as a force of nature, was able to kind of give it all a bit of an edge that anybody else might have struggled with.
And you can't really complain about if blues songs reiterate old ideas, because that's what the blues is. It's about reiterating and remaking and retooling all the rest of it. Sean, you're possibly the least bluesy person I know. What did you think of this record?
Controversial. I thought at times it sounded like Muse, and I quite like Muse. Yes, I was a bit confused about it sounding, again, a bit Lenny Kravitz, but the spirit of it I really liked. Anybody who has an album cover who's got a picture of them in hospital is A-OK with me. There's an amazing picture of Richard Lloyd. It isn't an album cover, but it should be, of him on a drip, smoking, near a no-smoking sign, when he was in hospital for being really mental. And we have Fantastic Negrito, who presumably, maybe that was when he had his bad accident 8 years ago, and he's in hospital, and it is Please Don't Be Dead. And I think that's fantastic. I say, I really like the spirit. If that was on, and I was at a party, because I go to loads of parties, I'd dance to that, or I'd have a boogie, but I didn't necessarily love it.
Yeah, I mean, what struck me was like there's an element of what would Lenny Kravitz be like if he had a sense of humour, which is almost impossible to imagine, but actually would be quite good.
Well, how do we know he may have a very good...
When I was at university a million years ago, somebody was talking about Lenny Kravitz and they mispronounced his name as Lanny Hendrix, which I thought was amazing because it's like a Lanny Henry does Jimi Hendrix, so like a comedy version of Hendrix. So that's always now fixed in my mind that Lenny Kravitz is Lenny Hendrix.
That tribute act probably already exists.
It should do.
He's like a young Lenny Henry. We can say that about him.
Something else that sort of leapt out to me is like it made me think, you know, what if old Dirty Bastard, who I think is a much maligned figure, he's a very tragic figure, but he had
his name's a bit of a giveaway there.
Yeah, but like, you know,
nice Dirty Bastard.
In my limited experience of him, he was like, you know, he's quite a nice bloke with that, and he had a good sort of comic insight into the world that he came from. He wasn't just this joke figure; he had things to say. And you know that album with him on the front, dressed as Donna Summer. This was a man with a great sense of humour, but he was not by any stretch of the imagination a prolific or a talented musician. He was a great figure. What if old Dirty Bastard was a multi-instrumental genius who could take all of these impulses of his mind and channel them into really clever, witty songs? It made me think. You know, Lenny Kravitz with a sense of humour. Old Dirty Bastard with brilliant musicianship and more kind of insight into himself. I thought this was a lot more interesting than I thought it was going to be, because generally I hate the blues. I'm a middle-aged white bloke. I hate the blues. But this kind of got me. I was quite swept away. Bits sound like Sly Stone and Prince, as is, you know, kind of mandatory when you're making a black rock record. But that's, you know, anyway. Shall we have a bit more music? Sean, you never get to choose a song. So you've got to choose one. What have you chosen?
Yeah, I'll choose one this week. I don't know how philosophical I can be about it and how metaphorical and how poetic, but I've chosen Making Plans for Nigel by XTC. I watched the Sky Arts XTC rockumentary, as they keep saying.
Which is brilliant.
I hadn't seen it, and it's fantastic, and it brought it all back. And I went back and listened to lots and lots of XTC, and I love this song. You could put it on any playlist, and I would get up and... boogie, sadly, in a punky sort of way. So it's Making Plans for Nigel, which still sounds fresh today.
It still sounds fresh today. We're going to play it now and run to your Skybox and watch the XTC documentary. You will love it. This is Making Plans for Nigel. Nigel is a nice spoken man. He likes to speak and he likes to be spoken to. XTC with Making Plans for Nigel, as chosen for reasons best known to herself, by Sean Patton. Finally, everybody's got an album that only they like. Either it sold no copies except to you, or everybody thinks it's terrible except you. Sometimes we're proud of it, sometimes it's a bit embarrassing. So we're going to ask our guests to fess up to theirs. First up, from the album that only Andrew Mueller likes, Georgia Hard by Robbie Fulks, this is Where There's a Road. A club to wreck and a town to burn, not a cent to waste, no rock unturned. Days like those you got to throw away. Robbie Fulks with Where There's a Road from the album Georgia Hard. Andrew, who is this? Why do you like them and why does nobody else like them?
It's a country record, which obviously I put in the running order just to annoy you. But no, this is Georgia Hard by Robbie Fulks is one of my very, very favourite albums of the entire 21st century. It was released in about 2005, which... at the risk of... Well, I won't tell the listeners more than they need to know, but it was a particular time at which... somebody was going to make an angry, sarcastic country record that I took completely to heart because that's what, you know, that's the kind of mood I was in. And this happened to be that record. I did know about Robbie Fulks slightly, but mostly as the composer of not quite novelty records, but almost. His most infamous song up until that point had been a song ruminating on his somewhat thwarted and frustrating experience as a professional songwriter in Nashville, and it was called Fuck This Town, which is a great tune. But
widely applicable.
Well, indeed. Georgia Hard does have a couple of just outright funny songs on it. There's one called Countryer Than Thou, in which he lambasts folks who are not from the South, much like myself, sort of becoming obsessive country music fans.
Well, Andrew, you are come from quite far south. It's hard to get further south than where you're from. You're from Wagga Wagga.
Not by Robbie Falks' definition of the South. and it does have a couple of very funny songs on it, but the rest of it, it's an absolutely beautifully pitched homage to the great countrypolitan phase of Nashville, the early 70s, when people like Billy Sherrill were making those gorgeous lachrymose ballads for people like George Jones. The title track is a song which I suspect is autobiographical, about a guy moving from the South to Chicago to be with a woman who then leaves him. So he's just marooned where, you know, as he says, there's no Carolina moon over Chicago. It's a lovely song. But the storytelling, the songwriting, the arrangements, there is not a duff note on the record. I don't think it was a complete commercial disaster, but it should have been much bigger.
Eamon, what have you chosen?
The song is a song called 100 Boys, which is by a little-known Dublin group called The Golden Howard, who were very much on the scene in the 80s and early 90s. And this album is unavailable anywhere. Some of the singles, so 100 Boys, Never Came Down, Endless Weekend, Friends in Time, are on YouTube. Search for a YouTube channel called Friends in Slime, and they're basically it's just a dumping ground for everything they did. They're basically like 13 Floor Elevators plus the New York Dolls plus the Ramones, so they're like a kind of glam punk band. And this their debut, well, not their debut album, because they had done EPs before, but in 1991 they self-titled Golden Horde album came out. Hot Press amazingly made it their joint album of the year, along with Acting Baby. That's wow. How big a noise they were in Dublin at the time. They're friends with U2, which I can forgive them for.
Yeah.
I saw them once live. They were just astonishing.
Well, let's have a listen and then we'll talk about it a little tiny bit more. This is from The Golden Horde by The Golden Horde from 1991. This is 100 Boys. I floated high above the road. That was great. It's the Ramones. They are basically the Irish Ramones.
No, absolutely. They are like Simon Carmody is about 6'9", probably, and he used to wear like a giant thick fur coat and like really pencil thin. And they were just amazing. And like they never really kind of caught outside of Ireland, really. I think if you speak to Irish people of a certain age, i.e. my age, they were a really formative band, because even though they were friends with the U2, they were probably the first indication in the late 80s that Irish bands didn't have to copy U2. So their template was kind of American punk and American psychedelia. And then just a few years after that, you had Therapy, who were very much a kind of US hard noise band. You had David Holmes, who was kind of bringing acid house to Ireland. So they were probably the first band that were kind of breaking away from that all-encompassing U2 epic rock sound that kind of plagued Irish music for so long.
And yet they were actually on U2's label, weren't they? They were on Mother,
yeah.
And, absurdly, you say you can't get this record anyway. You can't even get the album on Discogs.
No, it's impossible.
I've
got the CD at home, which I bought when it came out, and I've had an eye on Discogs for about 7 years to try and get it on vinyl. Just impossible.
So we're going to add the Golden Horde to our crowdfunded Micro Disney Fatima Mansions High Llamas gig.
Yes.
Golden Horde can play before Micro Disney to give them time to get their breath together. You know, so Carl and...
That seems reasonable. Yeah.
It's a four-hander. Speaking of Discogs, I tried to find 39 Minutes by Micro Disney, because you can't get that anywhere. No. £50.
Yeah.
£50 your CD on Discogs.
Really? I've got one of those.
£20 on Discogs.
I've got Kruger Mile on cassette at home in my parents' attic. But
I was just about to say, Andrew Miller can get Cackle to tape them all for us. So we'll
I think somebody's uploaded them to YouTube. I think a good chunk of those albums are on YouTube.
They are on YouTube. 39 Minutes and Crooked Mile on CD, I know, are so hard to find that when it emerged in conversation some years ago that I actually owned those, Cackle asked if he could borrow them so he could record them, because he didn't actually own them himself.
I'm not listening to music on YouTube anymore. any more than I'm going to have it played to me on a kazoo. That's a quality. Is not
kazoo
good
tube.
Ooh. Kazoo tube. Now, Eamon, amazing Golden Horde fact.
Yes.
You will have seen that they made a record with Robert Anton Wilson.
Yes, that was a really early... that was part of the chocolate biscuit conspiracy, because they were this weird kind of psychedelic collective. And it wasn't really until this album, The Golden Horde, that they kind of settled, that they kind of stripped everything down to be the New York Dolls, to be the Ramones. They were a bit more kind of sprawling, psychedelic. Those albums are quite easy to get on Discogs.
Okay.
But like the actual The Golden Horde and the singles from that are pretty much impossible to get. Also, interestingly, the B-side of Endless Weekend, one of the singles, the first track off this album, has them doing a cover version of My Cuckoo, which is really good.
Amazing.
So dig that up. Basically, go on YouTube, look for Franz and Slime, and that's it's got a lot of the stuff you mentioned that was on Bandcamp as well.
Yeah.
It is really worth digging into.
Okay, well, we're now coming towards the end of the show, which has gone over swiftly to an all Golden Horde format that we would have picked. Anyway, so,
all golden all the time.
All golden all the time. It's time for closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a prune martini at the local cocktail pop-up this weekend? Andrew Mueller, what's your closing time chatter?
Verite sound of me unzipping my bag to demonstrate the book in question. This is a book by an American music journalist called Peter Cooper, which I found by chance in a bookstore in Melbourne earlier this year, and I've only just got around to beginning to read because there was other stuff to read. It's called Johnny's Cash and Charlie's Pride. It's more country music, Andrew, just for you. And it's basically a collection of his anecdotage about his, you know, work in Nashville and his encounters with various country titans. And it's lovely. It's very smart. It's very funny. It's written in a slightly... Actually, I don't think it is affected. I think that's why it works. But a slightly self-consciously folksy style, which is incredibly hard to pull off consistently without getting annoying, and it does not get annoying. I think in the same way that it's the same rule that applies to the great country lyrics. If you overplay the folksiness, it starts to get cloying and sticky. But as it is, it's just very warm and funny. He is also quite a well-regarded country songwriter as well. The title Johnny's Cash and Charlie's Pride, I think, is the punchline to a slightly laboured joke, the question to which I no longer recall. But yeah, the subtitle explains what the book does, as a subtitle should, Lasting Legends and Untold Adventures in Country Music. And if you like that kind of thing, which I know you do not, but nevertheless...
You know what? I don't dislike it. I don't find it utterly repellent, like I find certain music. I have a bit of a country background. My dad was very big on country, and I'm actually going to send him the Robbie Fulks album and possibly get him this book.
If he likes it, because it does, it contains, well, the quotes on the back. It's an enviable list of blurbage he has from people like John Prine, Tom T. Hall, Chris Christopherson, Emmylou Harris, Porter Wagoner, and Hank Williams Jr. It's a great book. I'm really enjoying it.
So that's Johnny's Cash and Charlie's Pride by...
Peter Cooper.
Excellent. Eamon Ford, what's your closing time chatter?
My closing time chatter will probably get me drummed out of all music circles. It was triggered by Nick Cave headlining All Points East in London the other week. The Cure being on the cover of Q and Robert Smith curating Meltdown. And I thought, these acts are massive, and they clearly are like massively critically important, but they just like they cause no emotion in me. And I was thinking around of another artist that kind of falls into this camp, and it's Bruce Springsteen. And these are clearly great artists, but I listen to them. It's not that I hate them, because I can understand what they're doing. But do you know that the emoji with like the straight line for a mouth? That's me listening to The Cure. That's me listening to Nick Cave. That's me listening to Bruce Springsteen. And it's kind of, I was just wondering about this idea of music that provokes no response in you whatsoever. Because it's
opposite
not like
old Chemical Brothers records, music that triggers some kind of response. Yeah. You're going to do music that triggers no
response.
And I'm
thinking, is that like a great failure of pop to kind of trigger no emotion whatsoever? And you just completely look at it blankly and go, okay, that exists.
Have you always had artists like that, though? Because there's something I've noticed in myself as my years have advanced, that you know, when you're younger and you hear music you dislike, you take it personally almost.
Yeah.
You fly into blind, sanctimonious rages at it, and then you become a music journalist. Whereas what I find happens much more often the older you get is you hear something, you go, nah, but, you know, good luck to them.
Yeah, but it's but these were all kind of musicians that are, or that I should have been into. Certainly Nick Cave and The Cure growing up.
Yes, they're deemed alternative. They're deemed edgy.
Yeah, but that's
they
the kind of
response.
Stuff that I should have been into, and it just completely passed me by. And it's not like I hate them. I completely understand why people like them, but it's just it doesn't connect. And I'm just wondering if there's like massively critically acclaimed, hugely successful artists that just people just look go. Like that. It's like that Alan Partridge gif where he's like going, like he just shrugs.
I am a bit like that with Bruce Springsteen. I just like, I can say it's technically impressive and some of the songs seem to be pretty amazing, but it just no response at all.
Yeah, I bought a box set of Springsteen's albums up until probably, I can't remember, it kind of covered all the big ones. It certainly went beyond Born in the USA. It was like maybe the first seven or eight albums. And I played them all and just went, yeah, there's just no way in for me. It's clearly my fault rather than theirs, but there you go.
Mm. Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, there's going to be an amazing new programme on Netflix, everybody. Well. So let's not get so bored of Netflix now. There's a great article that's going around online about a scam artist called Anna Delvey, who pretended that she was a German aristocrat, an heiress, and scammed quite literally hundreds and thousands of dollars from individual people, from hotels, from banks, all sorts of things by cashing rogue checks. She was moved in high society in New York. She was going to start a version of Soho House in New York. And she scammed people. People believed that she was this person. She had no money at all. And she went around. She did it for years and years and years. She was about 23. She's in Rikers Island at the moment without bail. She pleaded not guilty, but she has been dumb for a little while before the trial goes to court. But Shonda Rhimes, who invented Grey's Anatomy and is a bigwig in American TV, is now at Netflix. And this is the first story she's bought. She's actually bought the article. The article, instead of the book, is the thing that she's paid the money for.
It is a great article.
It's very long.
Where is the article?
The article is in New York Magazine, and you can get it online. And it just is fascinating about the depths that this woman went to in order to con everybody.
And her name is?
Anna Delvey.
Okay, so if you Google Anna Delvey New York, you'll find this.
Yes,
it's
fantastic. It's a great story. And apparently all your Jennifer Lawrences and Margot Robbies are trying to get in there and be the main role, but we will see.
There's probably a great meta Netflix to be done about somebody finding a story like this and then loads of people wanting to make it into
a
Netflix
show. That's the other story, isn't it?
Can we just pause a moment to seethe in blind fury at the idea of a magazine article getting optioned by Hollywood or Netflix, because that's never happened to any of us, has it?
Yeah, well, my interview with Half Man, Half Biscuit is being currently in
Since Saturday Night Fever came ostensibly from a magazine article.
By Nick Cohn, I think I'm right in saying.
My On Vogue Bits piece is still available, everybody.
Absolutely, yeah. Yep. Smash It's Biscuit Tin. So my closing time chatter, surprisingly to everybody, will be they're showing classic old Doctor Who on Twitch, which is a gaming platform for the young people. The young people, Sean.
Are they showing my one? My episode?
Oh, well, Sean.
Oh, I'll get money for that. I'll get like Fiverr or something. Peter Davison was my doctor.
Which Dalek were you?
Oh, please. I was one of the assistants. We went young because something really bad happened from the baddie. So we turned into babies and I was in the mid-period of being an 11-year-old assistant.
So Charlotte went back in time and you were a teenage Tegan, weren't you?
I was
a teenage Tegan. Yeah. So what's happening is they're showing Classic Doctor Who on Twitch, which is a gaming platform for the young people. And the young people are really going mad for all of these black and white creaky shows made in 1965. And they're turning them into memes. And they're sort of, it's an online streaming platform. So next to the screen where you're watching the game or the show or whatever is scrolling comments, like in the style of the ancient pop-up video kind of thing. And so there's all these sort of like 17 and 18 year olds who are now sort of treating Ian Chesterton going London 1965 as if it's, the kind of, Willy Wonka sighing emoji or the kind of, the flat face smile emoji we were just talking about. Yeah. It seems to have opened up a completely new world of fans for this old TV show, that's which really obviously good. I love. I'm watching all the old ones, old fashioned style on DVD, and suddenly I'm finding that like 16 and 17 year olds are all into it as well.
Is this the new Simpsons wave, if people know about that? Go on YouTube and type in Simpsons wave. It's basically kids who've taken VHS copies of really early Simpsons episodes where it's all a bit wobbly and the picture frames readjust and stuff, and then they just make this kind of weird woozy music behind it, and it became this weird subgenre that was popular for about 3 minutes.
Well, I'm really
go in and Simpsons wave is just weird.
I'm holding out for Troughton wave and Hartnell wave then, if the youth are getting into black and white Doctor Who from 1966. And I'm currently watching what's commonly agreed to be the worst one that's ever been made, The Underwater Menace, where people are being turned into fish in order to solve the food problem. I still don't know how. And the evil guy, Professor Zaroff, is going to blow up the world, and we don't know why, and even he doesn't know why. Certainly the worst Doctor Who of all time. So go and check that one out as well.
Yay!
So that's the end of our show. Thanks to our special guest, Andrew Mueller. What are you up to next, Andrew?
I too have just delivered a book, so I'm in that strange zone in between euphoria and melancholy.
What is your next book?
It's an episodic history of Australian rules football, so literally no one in this entire hemisphere is going to be interested.
What's it called?
Probably going to be called Carn. C-A-R-N. It's a rendition of the Australian for what happens when someone tries to scream, come on. In a moment of football-induced passion. It's actually a reference to quite a well-known Australian poem about football called Life Cycle by Bruce Dawe.
All right. We'll keep an eye on that. Eamon?
I am going to go and tinker with my EMI book over the next couple of weeks and then send it off and then await the lawyer's letters.
There we go. Fantastic. Well, thanks, everyone, for coming. Thanks, as ever, to Sean for helping me to make the show intelligible, and to producer Jack Clarimont, who's in the background. Don't forget, you can hear all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. And if you want to support the show, you can buy us that virtual pint via Patreon at patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.